In the coming week, Poland holds its rescheduled presidential election. The anniversary of President Trump and Kim Jong-un's meeting at the DMZ is marked, and it's 75 years since the signing of the UN Charter. It's June 25th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Well, Bob, it's good to be back after taking a week off to recover from the rigors of recording our special summer reading, viewing, and listening episode. Let's kick off today's show by talking about Poland's upcoming presidential election. The election was originally scheduled to be held about 6 weeks ago, but was postponed because of the threat posed by the coronavirus. Now the election will be held on Sunday, June 28th. Bob, can you tell us what we need to know before Poles go to the polls?
Absolutely, Jim. People who are following the nation's affairs, the U.S. affairs, would be familiar with the one of the candidates because he just visited the White House. That would be Andrzej Duda. He's the incumbent. And he was the first foreign leader to visit since the sort of widespread outbreak and lockdown measures went into effect back in March for the coronavirus. So Mr. Duda, who's actually now, I believe he's now met President Trump five times. On five different occasions, he struck up a bit of a rapport with the president, came to the U.S., and neither side had any qualms about referencing the fact that this could be a boost to his presidential fortunes. So he is in a tight race with the mayor of Warsaw. His name is Rafał Trzaskowski. And he would need to get a majority of the votes to avoid a runoff. A runoff is expected by a lot of the people watching the Polish presidential scene and the election scene. And it's happening against a backdrop of Polish society struggling with what has been a move to the right, not just by Mr. Duda, but with the majority Law and Justice Party, which is the controlling party in parliament. There has been a pushback against a number of their moves. It's a little bit economic. It's a lot cultural. This is a nationalistic party. And Mr. Duda's campaign has actually decided to go after and rally around a conservative base on issues related to the LGBTQ community. He's actually called members of that community followers of an ideology, which he compared it and said was worse than communism. He's promised to protect popular social benefit programs that have supported families and pensioners. And so populist appeals to a conservative base and trying to get a boost from President Trump, who went out of his way to praise President Duda. And there was an overtone of some sort of military support as well. I don't think it was a rousing sense of U.S. military support in terms of sending troops leaving Germany to Poland per se, although there could be some troops cycling into Poland. We'll have to see how that plays out. But in general, look for the incumbent Andrzej Duda to make much of his recent visit to the White House.
Bob, first question really on the propriety of this visit. I've seen a lot of people criticizing the White House for hosting President Duda at this moment, that it really runs against a tradition in the United States of sort of distancing yourself during election time for other countries because you don't want to be seen as interfering. And there's a logic behind that argument, which is that you are likely to annoy whichever side loses because it looks like you're putting your finger on the scale. Can you assess that argument for me? I can't say I've done a deep dive as to what previous presidents have done on this score, but certainly there's a lot of talk that there's a norm being violated here.
Yeah, I think you kind of summed it up there, Jim. It is a norm. I myself also don't know how far back it dates, but fairly through multiple presidencies of both major parties. And you had a number of veterans of the State Department of again, people who served in former Republican and Democratic administrations saying this is bad form. U.S. should not be getting into this close to the election. It is putting its finger on the scales. It's something that President Trump was actually asked about during the visit and declined to answer. But he has not been shy about acting in this way for candidates that he favors. We've seen it with Benjamin Netanyahu, who went through multiple rounds of electioneering and came to the White House for basically a reaffirmation of the U.S. endorsement of his government, of his policies. And that was seen as unseemly. The president is, it doesn't seem to have made much impact on his decisions. I think there was also a bit of president eager to show that the country is open for business again, in a way, in terms of at least diplomatic business. Part of the tone of the appearance before media with President Duda was about countries eager to get moving again, to work together on vaccine research as well, but to just show that we're not going to be sequestered behind walls and masks anymore. Not that the White House was behind masks for too long, but to show that he's eager to get things moving again. We should also note there's a backdrop to the U.S. troops going to Poland is also the fact that they're leaving Germany and the fact that the German chancellor rebuffed the president's attempt to try to get a G7 summit on U.S. soil out of concern concern for, you know, too close socializing and the impact that would have. So there's a bit of that as well in the mix here, Jim.
As you point out, Bob, in terms of this norm, it has not been the case that the United States has avoided interfering with elections in other countries. There actually is a long history of that. The norm is about presidents being seen themselves.
Right, you have the public visit. Right,
very good point, visit. Though. So I just want, before people start sending me emails telling me about CIA operations and the like, I want to
just read the book Legacy of Ashes, and you'll find many, many examples of actual tampering going on.
But can you give us a better sense of the importance of the Polish president, Bob, in the Polish political system? Is it a president like in the United States who wields considerable power, or is it one of these systems where the president actually may be less important and the parliament and prime minister much more important?
It's more of the latter, Jim, but it's still very important for a few reasons, one of which is based on recent polling and other sort of opinion surveys involving the Polish public, there had seemed to be a perceptible move away from the right, let's say towards the center, if not towards the left. And there is great interest that if President Duda, as an incumbent with the Law and Justice Party, which has had almost absolute power in the country and has been moving the country in a rightward direction, has been consolidating control over the judiciary, has been clamping down on media freedoms, and which, by the way, has raised warnings from the European Union, of which Poland is a member, that it faces penalties for doing that further, that if Duda either outright loses or is forced to a runoff, it is showing, an erosion of support for law and justice, and Polish society having misgivings about the direction this party has taken the country. And it's a question about, you know, the strength of nationalism, populism in Poland, which is being closely watched because it's very important. The president, though, as a figurehead, can still sort of seize the news cycle by making charges like he has on the campaign trail about the LGBT community, for example, and where he sees Poland's place in the world. He actually has some practical power as well in terms of being able to veto legislation, which is actually not considerable. And so if the Law and Justice Party in Parliament was able to move in a direction with legislation that seen as infringing on the independence of courts, let's say, the president could step in and veto such legislation. That's seen as a very important step, obviously. Having the president and the Parliament in the same power gives the Law and Justice a very important poles of influence and power.
So this isn't a consequential election. And I will note an important point you touched on, Bob. The EU, most Western European countries are very unhappy with the turn that Poland has taken, as well as several other Central European countries, Hungary perhaps foremost. But those EU countries have not found a way to bring pressure to bear on those countries that are moving off in this more authoritarian, more populist, sort of illiberal democracy direction.
It's true. And I would just add one other thing, which is, potentially to a degree, unlike Hungary, Poland is still very much antagonistic towards Russia and is very interested in U.S. military support, is very interested in its NATO membership. It's one of the minority of NATO countries that have met its 2% of its GDP spending on defense areas. And even to the point where President Duda a couple of years ago said, you know, if the U.S. were to show enough interest in deploying troops in Poland, he could even see a Fort Trump being created and so forth. Now, there are troops that cycle through Poland as part of NATO, up to 4,500. Of them. And again, President Trump made a gesture towards more U.S. troops going to Poland. So there is that aspect, aside from the turning away from the liberal norms of the EU, there is a sort of a sense of wanting to strengthen its ties with NATO, which makes him a little bit different than some of the other populist causes. But Jim, I want to turn our attention to a notable anniversary in the coming week. It is the one-year anniversary of President Trump and Kim Jong-un meeting at the Korean Demilitarized Zone. Feels like a lot longer than a year ago, based on what certain things that have happened since then. But could you tell us a bit about, recreate that scene, and then what has happened since?
Certainly, Bob. But before I get into that, I want to remind everybody that we are taping and releasing this episode on the 70th anniversary of North Korea's invasion of South Korea. It was the indeterminate outcome of that war that created the conditions for the nuclear challenge we face today. And again, if you sort of go back 12 months, and like you, it sort of feels like it should be longer than a year, but Trump met Kim Jong-un at the Demilitarized Zone. It's the third meeting they had following up on summits in Singapore and Hanoi. It was the first time an American president had met the leader of North Korea. It was on North Korean soil. And President Trump came out of that meeting, as he had the previous two meetings with Kim Jong-un, talking about what a great success it was. He said, let me quote him here, "This was a great day. This was a very legendary, very historic day. it'll be even more historic if something comes out of it. And I think that tells the story of what happened afterwards. Nothing much has come out of it. Earlier this month, on the two-year anniversary of the Singapore summit, North Korea's foreign minister said that, and let me quote him, "Even a slim ray of optimism for peace and prosperity on the Korean peninsula has faded away into a dark nightmare." And he went on to say that North Korea's strategic goal now is to build up a more reliable force to cope with the long-term military threat from the United States. And obviously, if you're watching the news last week, North Korea blew up the inter-Korean liaison office on its side of the border. That was a building that had been used for joint talks between North and South Korea. And Kim Yo-jong, Chairman Kim's sister, called South Korean President Moon Jae-in disgusting and insane. So it looked like we were headed to a significant ratchet up in tensions. And then just yesterday, North Korea announces that it's halted its military plans directed at South Korea. It took the step of removing these large propaganda speakers mounted near the demilitarized zone that it had installed just days earlier. And then it went and scrubbed a whole array of anti-South Korea news stories on North Korean media outlets, and which had a lot of people sort of scratching their head trying to make sense of what exactly is going on in North Korea. And I think the answer is we really don't know. Many people who study North Korea for a living would say this is the same old, that is, the North Koreans like to provoke and then step back, raise the temperature, then lower it, keep you off your feet. One of the big unknowns here is how is North Korea affected by the coronavirus? There's some reason to suspect it's having real problems containing the control of the virus. But again, this is an incredibly closed society. It's hard to know what is happening.
Yeah, it is really hard to follow. And we try to at CFR, and obviously your studies unit is tracking the developments there really closely. And yet we're kind of just hostage to the latest events and then gauging those as opposed to being able to really forecast what's going on. It does seem like, as you cite the playbook, the North Korean playbook, at the very least, they were interested in getting the U.S. attention again, seeing it as drifting, as nothing much of any substance was happening on any front regarding North Korea, whether it's U.S. easing of sanctions or the North Koreans taking any steps to denuclearize. None of that seems to be happening. I wonder if the latest round of steps in any way involves further sort of jostling among so-called North Korean elites, or whether there is something going on in the coronavirus realm and they're going to need South Korean help more than they realize.
Well, again, Bob, we don't know. And even if North Korea is handling the coronavirus pandemic well, one of the ways it will have done that is by really clamping down on its border with China. And there was evidence that both the North Koreans and the Chinese early on did just that. But the problem with that is that there was a lot of smuggling going across that border, bringing goods into North Korea, which is an incredibly badly run economy, given its sort of autarkical nature. And so we really don't know what is sort of percolating there. I will say, you know, our colleague Scott Snyder recently came out with what we call a contingency planning memorandum update entitled Renewed Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, in which he sort of looked at, you know, what challenges the United States may face in the next several months, precisely because to some extent North Korean behavior is predictable. And one of the concerns a lot of North Korean experts have had is, will Chairman Kim view the American presidential election as an opportunity for him, either because he thinks he can extract concessions from President Trump, who doesn't want to have tensions in the run-up to an election, or he believes that the administration will be distracted and hence he can put pressure to bear on the South Koreans. So there's a lot going on here. And again, this has always been the problem dealing with North Korea. We don't really have a good understanding of how that regime operates. And the tendency is to say, well, this is just the same movie on rerun. The problem is that if you're wrong, the consequences could be catastrophic.
Those are all good points, Jim. I think it's also worth revisiting some of the analysis that happened both last year and in the previous Trump-Kim meetings about the problem of Kim or any other authoritarian leader gaining a meeting with a U.S. leader without really sort of paying for it or without any sort of serious upfront agreement coming before it. It just seemed like they were meetings for the sake of meetings, extraordinary though they were, without having a sort of a serious agenda that was going to be actionable and having something that preceded the meetings. It was all sort of a bit of a show and not much substance.
Well, I think there's an element of truth to that, Bob, but to be fair, the old American playbook in dealing with North Korea hadn't produced any breakthroughs either. We had sort of, again, seen the same TV series over and over and over again. So you can credit the president trying to sort of take a dramatic step to break through the deadlock, create a new dynamic. I don't think that was necessarily the problem. The problem was is that when we had the first meeting in Singapore, there was no clear meeting of the minds, but the president came out of it talking as if there had been one. And in some sense, the two sides talked past one another. And that became particularly clear at the second summit in Hanoi, where it's pretty clear that the North Koreans thought they were going to get major concessions from the United States, and they didn't. And I think that sort of created a lot of turmoil on the North Korean side. But again, take it up to the current situation where we are right now. The question is, how do you deal with a North Korea that has an even larger nuclear force, a more capable nuclear force than it did before the president began his diplomacy? And again, this is a problem that goes back several administrations. When the president says, I inherited this problem from my predecessors, he's quite right. Because to this point, we've always judged the costs of a direct confrontation with North Korea to not be worth it. And then the question is, if that is the case, and it's truer today, obviously, than it was before North Korea was a nuclear power, what do you do? And I don't think anyone has any good answers.
And I think the South Koreans, who know more about this than anybody, are probably still trying to sort this out. And as you say, the presidential election will be the next big tipping point.
You're certainly right, Bob. And I will note that the South Koreans themselves have produced their own so-called sunshine policy toward North Korea, trying to entice the North Koreans with incentives, carrots, so to speak. That hasn't worked very well either. And I'll note that today, on the anniversary, 70th anniversary of the invasion of South Korea, President Moon Jae-in really called on North Korea to try to join with South Korea in an open dialogue. But speaking of anniversaries, I should note that this week is the 75th anniversary of the signing of the UN Charter. The Charter was signed in San Francisco on June 26, 1945, and came into force the following October. So obviously this October will be the 75th anniversary of the actual commencement of the United Nations. Now, the UN Charter calls for the UN to, and let me quote, maintain international peace and security, promote social progress and better standards of life, strengthen international law, and promote human rights. So I have to ask, Bob, 75 years on, did the UN live up to its founding vision?
I'd say in many respects, I would say yes. I think it's worth noting that the initial ambitions came mere months after the end of just the absolutely devastating World War II, and in terms of every corner of the world being touched.
Well, I should know, end of World War II in Europe, because obviously the war was still being fought in the Pacific.
Yes, good point. End of World War II in Europe, and just months before it would end in Japan. And it had been, this notion of a UN had been discussed for a number of years. The U.S. was a big driver behind it, and you had in San Francisco bipartisan U.S. support for this charter, for this organization, with the goal of, yeah, creating an international peace and security organ. You know, when you talk about the UN, one of the challenges, of course, is talking about the UN as this one thing, and it's many things. But if you just start with the UN Security Council, you can point to wins, you can point to losses, you can point to sins of commission and omission. More recently, the sad tale is that you have an anachronistic body in many ways that's set up reflecting the world as it existed 75 years ago. So let's look at the veto-wielding members of the UN Security Council. There's five, and they are Russia, you know, previously Soviet Union, China, which joined in that capacity about 40 years ago, United States, France, and the UK. You don't have India in any capacity, for example, which is lobbied to be joining, or some other major countries in other parts of the world. Continent of South America not represented. Africa is underrepresented. You do have 10 rotating members that come in for 2 years at a time, but it's a body that gets tied up in self-interest. Currently, you have it tied in knots over a number of things. They couldn't even agree on a pandemic ceasefire. The U.S. got bogged down in some language with other, I think, believe Russia and China over the way to characterize that. And so, and Syria being one of the crowning sort of failures of the Security Council to actually step in and stop the world's worst, I would say, over the last 10 years, conflict from getting to the point it got to. The country's absolutely devastated. you know, hundreds of thousands dead, millions upon millions displaced or as refugees. And it's now in an end game that's probably going to cause more strife, more flight, more death, and possibly disease with the coronavirus itself, you know, spreading into refugee and benighted zones of Syria. So as an organ, the Security Council needs a great deal of reform. And even if you just take it at its current composition, something has to change to make it more effective and live up to what its founding purpose was. And we should also note in its early phase, there was kind of this stalemate that involved the Soviets pitted against the Western countries on the Security Council. But it didn't seem to be as sort of actively at counter purposes as it is now.
You know, Bob, as you were talking, I'm reminded, of course, that what we're talking about right now connects with our last topic, North Korea. Because obviously in 1950, when the North Koreans invaded South Korea, the United Nations acted in the sense that people had anticipated it would act in the face of aggression and a threat to world peace. The United Nations endorsed military operation to repel the invasion across the 38th parallel. But that happened, and it was the only time it happened, precisely because the Soviet Union boycotted a critical UN Security Council meeting.
A mistake they did not make again, but Russia has not made since then.
Correct. And no other veto-wielding member of the Security Council has missed a meeting where it thinks its interests are going to be run over by the others. But the reason I think that is so important is it highlights the reality of the United Nations, which is the United Nations, in many sense, was oversold by its proponents. Because at the end of the day, the UN is not this free-floating supranational right. government that can dictate to countries. It has always been a vessel that can do only as much as its member states want it to do. And as you rightly point out, five of those countries matter a lot more than everybody else, even though if you were to start to rank countries in terms of, let's say, economic output, the countries that are there, like France and Great Britain, no longer are quite the heavyweights they were at the end of World War II. So I think, you know, there's a lot of good to be said about the United Nations. And I recognize for the, you know, the U.S. out of the UN, UN out of the U.S. crowd, yes, it's an inefficient organization. There's a lot of waste in what it does. But a lot of that is just a function of the fact that's the kind of organization that its members want.
Yeah, it's a good point, Jim. As I think back to the trajectory of it too, you know, it was not that long ago that even with its flaws and its sort of well-known debacles such as inaction in Rwanda or in the Srebrenica massacre in the Balkans, there was still a self-correction mechanism going on in the UN and a transparency mechanism. Another example is the oil for food debacle in Iraq, where the UN set up this whole system to feed Iraqis, which was gamed, including by Security Council members, to line their own pockets. The UN ended up enlisting Paul Volcker to oversee a very straightforward effort to get to the bottom of it. And the countries on that were found to be at fault, that were democracies, took corrective steps, and the ones that were not did not. That's another challenge the UN faces. But the big problem I think we're looking at now, and there's more to note on this, including from our own think tank, is the rising role of China, which would like to have the UN sort of do its bidding in more places. China's taking a more active role in trying to seek leadership in UN agencies. And there's a new piece we have up on our website by Yan Zhanghuang and Josh Kurlansik that looks at how China is basically reasserting itself in all sorts of ways, including at the UN. And this was U.S. territory for many years. U.S. is still the largest funder of the UN. It's host to the UN in its premises in New York. And even with its problems and the U.S. out of the UN crowd, as you say, there's still a public sentiment that the UN does valuable work, and especially when the U.S. gets engaged in it. And so the challenge, I think, is going to be having countries who see the UN as a vehicle that they can use for good. I also think about areas like some of the peacekeeping areas where the UN maybe was not up to it, but it helped endorse or authorize missions that did good. So the so-called coalitions of the willing led by Australia and East Timor, for example, and then the UN ended up overseeing kind of a nation-building enterprise there. Or in Sierra Leone, it was a British-led coalition of willing that ended the nightmare that country faced in the 90s. And other issues against conflict diamonds. These are Security Council initiatives. Even in Iraq, where the U.S. famously could not get support of a majority of UN members to support its invasion against Saddam Hussein, who was in there in Iraq leading the way in nation building initially? It was the United Nations. It was a UN mission. And they suffered a horrible bombing that killed the head of the mission, Mr. Vieira de Mello, back in summer of 2003. But there was this built into the UN system, into its DNA at the time, was this sense that, you know, democracy was going to be, and building democratic countries was going to be the way that you recreated and rebuilt countries. And you're not seeing that anymore. And you're seeing China and Russia wield much more effective power in the UN, especially through the Security Council.
Bob, you mentioned Iraq and you mentioned oil for food. And I should note that while it was the case that the United Nations never replicated the UN military high command, as happened in the case of the war on the Korean Peninsula back in 1950, the UN did authorize the United States and others to move against the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait back in what became the Gulf War. But again, that highlights the broader point, which is that the UN is able to mobilize and to bless when its most important members can agree that something needs to be done. And absent that consensus, the UN is always going to be limited in what it can accomplish, because again, at the end of the day, it is an institution that does what its members want it to do.
Jim, we have talked our way into the figure of the week section of this podcast. So I have to ask you, Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number, and I am going with the number 27, as in the number of members of the EU, which is currently considering the rules under which restrictions on travel from outside the European Union will be relaxed. Now, this is a very important decision that has economic and diplomatic consequences. The economic consequences are easy to understand. Tourism is huge business in Europe. Every year, tourists flood the continent to see the Eiffel Tower, take a gondola ride in Venice, or drink in the beauty of Santorini. Now, Europe wants to welcome tourists that are least likely to bring the coronavirus while holding off those more likely to bring it. But telling the citizens of some countries to, hey, come on over, but saying not so fast to the citizens of others has the potential to create a lot of diplomatic heartaches. And that's especially true, as seems to likely be the case, if one of the countries on the outside looking in is the United States. And the reason is simple. The United States has failed to bring the spread of the coronavirus under control. The EU Commission is contemplating a limit on citizens coming in from countries with infection rates at or below the EU's. And if that is the rule the EU adopts, the United States won't make the cut. Now, the United States isn't going to be the only country facing a red light. Brazil and Russia, among other countries, likely will as well, because they too have above average infection rates. But here's what makes this a really interesting and challenging diplomatic issue for the Europeans. China reported infection rate is below the EU average. So China might well get a green light. Now, there's been a lot of talk this week about whether the United States will in fact get shut out. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he is very confident a solution is going to be found. And, you know, one possibility is that the Europeans could pick a very low number, which in essence keeps most people out. Of course, that won't be popular with European governments whose people rely on tourism to make the economy go, but it may be popular with politicians who are worried about the domestic political costs of welcoming visitors who are subsequently tied to a spike in coronavirus cases that would send Europe back into a lockdown. On the other hand, my sense is that some European officials don't see any need to cut the United States any breaks. And after all, it was the Trump administration that unilaterally halted air travel to Europe earlier this year and did so without giving European capitals a heads up. In some countries, France comes immediately to mind, have been insisting that reciprocity should govern all of these decisions. If you let in my citizens, I'll let in yours. And here's what it's just the sort of the kicker in all of this, which is that the EU's rule won't be binding on its member states, which raises the possibility the EU could adopt a rule. Some states don't follow it. Now, that means people could go into one country when they couldn't get into another. But obviously, within the European Union, the so-called Schengen area, you can move around. So Europe could potentially end up in a situation where it alienates Washington, but doesn't get a lot of the benefit economically or in terms of sort of holding off the spread of the virus. And this takes us back to the big problem of them all, which is how do you restart global business in an age of COVID-19?
No, and it gets back to a lot of points that have been already raised many times in this pandemic, which is the absence of any kind of a global organizational or just sort of a global movement that's united, not only in fighting the virus, but making common cause in how the global economy should function and the to travel among states, all these types of things. Instead, it became this, unfortunately, because a lot of countries have looked to the U.S. to lead in this regard. Instead, it came down to, you know, the nationalist impulses, I think, sorry to say, of the Trump administration in terms of antagonizing countries, making unilateral decisions, not joining in on discussions on global vaccine efforts, for example, and then deciding to demonize China, which has a lot to answer for in the way this erupted, without trying to work towards a solution to try to, first of all, get this pandemic under control and then avoid the next one around the corner. All of it, on top of which the administration is fomenting this dispute over the wearing of masks, which when you look at the graphs that have been distributed this week showing the infection levels of Europe or EU countries versus the US, it's just staggering. You know, one had hoped that the flattening of the curve language would have been dispensed with a month or two ago. Instead, the curve is getting bigger. It's not flattening. It is growing. And there are too many US states that are not acting responsibly. Some are now scrambling as they see the infection rates taking off. But it raises big concerns and it raises further questions about the capacity for the US to behave properly in this and show any kind of leadership.
Well, I'll just note, Bob, in terms of the U.S. curve not flattening but going back up, we had this conversation early on about the real challenge domestically for the United States of trying to clamp down. If you succeeded in one area but it popped up in another part of the country, you could end up back where you started because people move, people travel. And we're seeing that right now where the state of New York has announced it expects people from certain other states to have to undergo a 14-day quarantine. I don't know how you actually make that work, but again, it highlights this problem. And for those who say, well, too bad for Americans who can't go to Europe, you know, you'll have to just go somewhere at home for your vacation. I just want to note that for many American cities and towns, tourism, foreign tourism is a big deal. Hawaii is an obvious case, but again, think Disneyland, Disney World, you know, Universal Studios and the rest. There are a lot of places in this country where people depend a lot on tourism.
You know, the city where we're based, Washington, there's usually many, many tourists walking down the mall and visiting.
Well, and as someone who lives in Washington, I guess I don't mind if we have fewer tourists for a while so I can walk on the street.
Fewer scooters.
And not bump into people reading maps or get run over by scooters. But anyway, Bob, who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, and his name is Michael Pack. He is the new CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media. This is the U.S.-funded entity responsible for overseeing broadcasters like The Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and Radio Free Asia. And Mr. Pack is in the news because he, after being confirmed in the Senate, acted very swiftly to proceed to sack the leaders of all of those entities I just mentioned and a few others and raise concerns that have seemed to be facing inquiry by Democratic lawmakers about what he plans to do in terms of affecting the broadcasting and the independence of the broadcasting of entities like the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and Radio Free Asia. At a crucial time, while the places where these broadcasters are especially in need, authoritarian countries really have great need of these services, and there's a great deal of concern that they might be steered in a direction where their news reporting and other types of broadcasting and other things might be less credible, and their credibility is really their stock in trade.
It's a big story, Bob, and we'll have to sort of see how this unfolds in the weeks and months to come, but it doesn't strike me as good news.
No, I mean, one initial step that Mr. Pack has made is reasserting the prominence of an editorial coming from the U.S. Now, through the years, the VOA was always required to post an editorial via the State Department on some issue that matters. But it was not sort of the dominant aspect of its work. The VOA is sort of the go-to news source still in a number of countries in Africa, for example. And it would clearly identify the op-ed that it was distributing and then go from there. And now its leadership stepped down ahead of the firings that took place recently in anticipation of Mr. Pack trying to put in his own picks. But now the Voice of America, its webpage is being ordered to, according to most recent reports, prominently post this editorial and make more of a statement of it. I think the voice aspect of Voice of America is seen as being interpreted maybe a different way. I think the other thing we need to watch, Jim, is there's a bit of a differing interpretations of the extent to which this CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media has power, or whether there is any sort of existing firewall between the U.S. government and these broadcasters. That is going to be really interesting. It could make its way into the courts. There actually have been some court challenges filed already. Some of these decisions could make their way through the courts. It's going to be worth watching.
So watch this space.
Yes. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Thousands of Hong Kong residents are set to stage their annual July 1st protest, which marks the anniversary of the handover from Britain to China. And a constitutional referendum takes place in Russia.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Graitzer, Noah Mulligan, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. Zoe Collis also served as our recording engineer this week. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy.